Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is June 8th, 2004. Today's session number is SCM 2004-01. Today's speaker are John and Mary Schramm. The lesson for today is Dorothy Day, Radical Faithfulness. This is session 2 of Living Faithfully. A look at the life of Dorothy Day and the radical nature of the Christian command to follow Jesus.
My name is Mary Schramm, and John and I this week are doing something that Janet asked us to do. When she said the theme was Living Faithfully, she asked us to share some people that we thought lived faithfully in their lives. So the first three sessions, as John said yesterday, are going to be individual people, and then the last two will be dealing with how we can live faithfully. Yesterday, you heard about a monk. I don't know if there could be more of a contrast between Thomas Merton and Dorothy Day. They're just miles apart in my estimation, but I think you'll find a lot of things that they have in common. At least their lifestyles were very, very different. I picked Dorothy Day because she's one of the women that I admire most. I also find her to be very intimidating as well as inspiring. And I find myself both in awe of her and frightened by the very radical nature of her lifestyle. So as I read about her, I was both compelled and repelled by her brand of Christianity, her insistence that we follow Jesus, literally do what Jesus said to do, and her love affair later on in life with the Roman Catholic Church. She had a deep loyalty to the Roman Catholic Church, so much so that many of her friends kind of rolled their eyes back and shook their heads and walked away from her. But I also find that Dorothy Day lived out a very strange and wonderful kind of Christianity. Her faith and her philosophy are summed up in the phrase, "We have all known the long loneliness, and we have learned that the only solution is love, and that love comes with community." Dorothy Day was born in 1897. 1897. She was the daughter of a sports writer who eventually was the editor of the New York Morning Telegraph, and her father also started the Hialeah racetrack in Florida. Her family was staunchly Republican, which I find very interesting, and nominally Episcopalian. Her grandfather on her father's side was Dr. Sam Houston Day, who was a Confederate who was a surgeon in the Confederate Army. And on her mother's side, her grandfather was Napoleon Bonaparte Satterley. He was a chairmaker from New York. Dorothy had two older brothers. She was a middle child. And then she had a younger sister and a younger brother for whom she cared when she was just a teenager. In her mid-teens, she went to the University of Illinois and became a socialist. She stayed there for about 2 years, decided she would go back to New York, where she fell in with the Bohemian set. Now, I'm not even sure what a Bohemian set is. Were they the hippies, like the hippies of the 60s? She congregated and had many, many friends among communists, anarchists, and socialists. She frequented the 4th Street Bar in New York, where Eugene O'Neill also hung out. And she writes something about her, one of the early kind of longings or urges within her life to perhaps become a Christian, because she certainly was not at this time, but she said she loved to hear Eugene O'Neill read. "It was one of those cold, bitter winter evenings when I first heard The Hound of Heaven, that magnificent poem of Francis Thompson. Gene," she called him Gene, "could recite all of it, and he used to sit there looking dour and black, his head sunk on his chest, saying, 'And now my heart is as a broken font wherein tear drippings stagnate.' It was one of those poems that awakens the soul and recalls to it the fact that God is its destiny. The idea of this pursuit fascinated me. The inevitableness of it, the reassurance, recurrence of it, made me feel that inevitably I would have to pause in my mad rush of living to remember my first beginning and my last end. She was a voracious reader. She read D.H. Lawrence, Pascal, Chesterton, Dickens, Henry Miller, and the late Martin Luther King. And she said, "The reason I am not a Christian is because I have never met a Christian in the socialist movement." In her early 20s, she became a freelance journalist, reporting the action for a New York paper, but more often being part of the action herself. She was a chain smoker, something that she prayed about later in life. She could drink anyone under the bar. She searched as frantically for love and good sex as she did for answers to the plight of women and many poor people in the world. She talks about one of the other urges or things that she saw early on. "You'd be surprised, but there was many a morning after sitting all night in a tavern or coming from balls over at Wester Hall that I went to an early mass at St. Joseph's Church on 6th Avenue. It was just around the corner from where I lived, and seeing people going to an early weekday mass attracted me. What were they finding there? I seemed to feel the faith of those about me, and I longed for that faith. My own life was sordid, and yet I had the occasional glimpses of the true and beautiful. So I used to go and kneel in the back pew of St. Joseph's, and perhaps I even asked, I'm not sure, but maybe I did, 'God be merciful to me, a sinner.'" She married, lived briefly in Mexico where she did some nursing. She was not trained as a nurse, but the books say that she did some nursing down there. Then she divorced, and at the age of 28, she entered into a common law marriage with a young biology instructor named Forrest Batterton. 3 years later, Dorothy Day gave birth to her first child, Teresa, her only child. And her gratitude for this and the awe of the experience she expresses in this part. "My child was born in March at the end of a harsh winter. In December, I had come in from the country to take a little apartment in town. It was good to be there, close to friends, close to this church where I would still stop in and pray. I read The Imitation of Christ a great deal, and I knew that I was going to have my child baptized a Catholic, cost what it may. I knew I was not going to have her floundering through many years as I had done, doubting and hesitating, undisciplined, amoral. I felt it was the greatest thing that I could do for my child. For myself, I prayed for the gift of faith. I was sure, yet not sure, so I postponed the day of decision. A woman doesn't want to be alone at such a time. Even the most hardened and most irreverent is awed by the stupendous fact of creation. No matter how cynically or casually the world may treat the birth of a child, it remains spiritually and physically a tremendous event. God pity the woman who does not feel the fear, the awe, and the joy of bringing a child into the world." So God's Spirit continued to work in Dorothy Day, and as she said, she didn't want her daughter floundering through life, drinking people under the bar and having good sex or whatever. She wanted her to be grounded in the Christian faith. And so in December 1927, finally the great day arrived and was then a thing of the past. Teresa was baptized and became a member of the mystical body of Christ. I didn't know anything of a mystical body, or I might felt disturbed and separated from her. But I clutched her close to me, and all that summer as I nursed her and bent over that tiny round face at my breast, I was filled with a deep happiness that nothing could spoil. But the obstacles to my becoming a Catholic were still there, the shadows in the background of my life. I had become convinced that I would become a Catholic, and yet I felt that to do so, I was betraying the class to which I belonged, to my brothers, to the workers, to the poor of the world, the class which Christ loved the most and spent his life with. She finally decides to become baptized, and it isn't all that great aha moment for her, and I'll read you what she says. It was in December of 1927, a most miserable day, and the trip was long from the city down to Tottenville, Staten Island. All the way on the ferry through the foggy day, I felt grimly that I was being too precipitate. I had no sense of peace, no joy, no conviction that what I was doing was right. It was just something that I felt I had to do, a task to be gotten through. I doubted myself when I allowed myself to think. I hated myself for being weak and vacillating back and forth. A most consuming restlessness was upon me that I walked around and around the deck of the ferry, almost groaning in anguish of spirit. I thought the devil was on the boat. But Sister Alicia was there waiting for me to be my godmother. I don't really know if I had any other godparent. Father Hyland, gently, with reserve, with matter-of-factness, heard my confession and baptized me. I was Catholic at last, though at the moment I never felt less joy and peace and consolation, which I know from my own later experiences that religion can really bring. A year later, my confirmation was a very joyful thing, and Pentecost never passes without a renewed sense of happiness and thanksgiving. It was only then that the feeling of uncertainty finally left me, never again to praise God, never again to return praise God. So she becomes baptized along with her daughter Teresa, but this caused a great rift in her common law marriage. Her husband was an atheist. Life was very difficult for them, so she separated from her common law husband. And for the next 5 years, she barely supported herself and her daughter on some not so good fiction that she was writing. Things began to change in 1932 when she covered a hunger march from New York City to Washington, D.C. When the demonstration was over, she went to the National Shrine at Catholic University, where she offered up a special prayer that some way might open up for her to use her talents for the working class and the poor. When she got back to her apartment, there was Peter Maurin. And if you know anything about Dorothy Ney, you've probably heard of Peter Maurin also. He was a stocky French hobo, a philosopher, and a socialist. A friend who knew both Peter and Dorothy said, "Boy, you guys have things so much in common. You ought to get together. You ought to learn to know one another." Because their values were similar, she agreed to spend time with Peter Maurin, discovered that he was a visionary rather than an activist like Dorothy Day. Every community has to have one of each, at least. And Peter had this vision for a utopian communist community, Christian communist community. From that day forward, Dorothy Day's life changed dramatically. She confesses later in her writings that when she first met Peter Maurin, she didn't even like him very well. He didn't like music, he didn't read very much, he rarely bathed, he never changed his clothes, his glasses were always askew, and he had this one-track mind. A friend of ours says that prophets are hemorrhoids in his life, and I'm sure that's what Peter Maurin was to Dorothy Day, a hemorrhoid in her life. But on May Day, 1933, just 5 months after meeting, Dorothy Day and Peter Maurin founded the Catholic Worker, a monthly newspaper designated to make known the expressed and implied teachings of Christ. A newspaper that was going to make known the expressed and implied teachings of Christ. She talks in this little book called Meditations on how she scraped enough together $57, which was what she needed to get 2,500 copies of this 8-page newspaper printed. She had written an article and got $5 for that, and some nuns sent a dollar from some offering at a church. And after about a week, she said, if we'd had a mimeograph, we'd have just, you know, rolled off like many people did at that time. But they didn't even own a mimeograph machine, so they had to take it to a printer. So the first copy of The Catholic Worker was 2,500 copies for $57. But within 2 years, the circulation was over 100,000 copies, and the paper was sold worldwide. And you know the price, don't you?
A penny
a copy. Okay. They wanted to build a society in which it was easier for people to be good. And I want to talk about that later. I'm not sure exactly what Peter Maurin and Dorothy Day meant by that. To build a society in which it was easier for people to be good. Our friend Abigail McCarthy in D.C. said that the Catholic Worker was the single biggest influence on the Catholic intellectuals in the United States. And as someone else said, I think Coleman McCarthy in an article, it was like a prowling animal outside the doors of America's deaf and lazy institutions. So in the area around Washington Square, the communist workers would be standing out there yelling, "Read the Communist Worker!" And Dorothy Day and Peter Maurin would be saying, "Read the Catholic Worker!" Peter had wanted to call it the Catholic Radical, which would have been a very good name, because radical is like radishes. It's rooted. It's getting at the roots of what Christianity is all about. But Dorothy Day wanted to counter the Catholic Worker, or the Communist Worker paper, so they called it the Catholic Worker. The paper espoused the radical idea that to be a Christian, one had to do what Jesus commanded, to give your life for the poor and oppressed. But how was that to be done? The utopian Christian communism that they envisioned soon became known as the Catholic Worker Movement, and it had the following tenets. First of all, voluntary poverty. Voluntary poverty. This was Peter Maurin's insistence, insisted on this. He said, you must give up your life in order to save it. Voluntary poverty is essential. To start poor, to live poor, to make beginnings even when the meager means at hand is how to begin. St. Francis of Assisi thought that to choose to be poor is just as good as marrying the most beautiful girl in the world. Most of us seem to think that Lady Poverty is an ugly girl, not the beautiful girl that St. Francis says she is. And because we think so, we refuse to feed the poor with our superfluous goods. Instead, we let the politicians feed the poor, going around like pickpockets, robbing Peter to pay Paul. Dorothy Day wanted to make very sure that people did not confuse the destitute poverty of the poor and needy with the voluntary poverty of middle-class Christians or middle-class people. Speaking about their houses of hospitality, she said, I feel strongly that we have to put everything we have into enhancing voluntary poverty for ourselves. It's only when we do this can we expect God to provide for us. And she said, look at Miss So-and-so, some nurse that was working with them. She's divesting herself of all her possessions so that she can give herself to others. The second tenet besides voluntary poverty was feeding the hungry and sheltering the homeless. A group of Christian radicals that were interested in this movement decided to move into a house together. Someone gave them a house on Mott Street in New York. They decided to move in and work on the newspaper together to support one another. The door was always open. They wanted to have a Christ room, a room where people could come and feel the presence of Christ. And it seems to me that the Christ figure early on was a man named John Griffin. He was from the Bowery. He came in one day hungry, kind of stayed, made this his home. He was always there to hand out the clothing of the people that lived in the house to anybody that came and needed something to wear. You know, if you have two coats in your closet, you've stolen it from somebody else. Somebody needs that. Well, the clothing all ran out very quickly, and then he started just offering conversations and listening to people and offering coffee. Then John Griffin decided, well, we should share the food we have. And even though the people living in the Catholic worker house didn't have much food, they shared what they had, and word spread like wildfire, because this was the 1930s, 1932, the Depression. There were many, many hungry people, and the lines around the house went for blocks, lining up to get food. Well, people in New York City heard about this crazy group down there, and they started, nuns and college students started coming down, giving contributions, bringing food, bringing blankets, all the things that were necessary to feed the homeless and to shelter those that they could. This was not something planned, Dorothy Day says. But it's funny how things happen. No one of us was asked to do this work. The mayor of the city didn't come along and ask us to run a bread line or a hospice to supplement the municipal lodging house, nor did the bishop or cardinal ask that we help out Catholic charities in their endeavor to help the poor. No one asked us to start an agency or an institution of any kind. On our responsibility, because we are our brother's keeper, because of a sense of personal responsibility, we begin to try to see Christ in each one that came to us. If a man came in hungry, there was always something in the icebox. If he needed a bed and we were crowded, there was always a quarter around to buy a bed on the Bowery. If he needed clothes, there were our friends to be appealed to after we had taken the extra coat out of our closet first, of course. It might be someone else's coat, but that was all right too. Our houses of hospitality were scarcely the kind of houses that Peter Maurin had envisioned in his plan for a new social order. He recognizes that himself and thinks of terms in terms of the future to accomplish true centers of Catholic action. Our houses grew up around us. Our bread lines came by accident. Our round table discussions, our unplanned, spontaneous affairs. The smaller the house, the smaller the group, the better it would be, we thought. If we could get down to be Christian families, we would be content. Ever to become smaller, that is the aim. And they knew him in the breaking of the bread. This is what the Catholic worker people felt. They knew Christ in the breaking of the bread. And one of the, I just read in the Wenatchee World the other day that one of the new wine centers, we have a lot of wine centers around here now, they were having a very special party, and you would pay $75 or $100 for a four-course meal, and they gave the menu. I didn't even know what anything was. And then the wine in between, it just struck me as being rather strange that someone would pay $75 or $100 for this kind of a meal. And this Dorothy Day writes about the scavenger hunt. She said, this was in the New York paper, a scavenger hunt is the latest game of society, a hilarious pastime, the New York Times Society reporter calls it, and describes in 2.5 columns the asinine procedure of several hundred society and literary figures, guests at a party at the Waldorf Astoria, surging forth on a chase through the highways and byways of Manhattan Island. The scavenger hunts of last night brought an enthusiastic response from every person whose appetites for diversion are ordinarily jaded. The hunt was a search through the city streets for a ridiculously heterogeneous list of articles. Any morning before and after Mass and straight through the day, there is a scavenger hunt going up and down 15th Street, out the windows of the Catholic worker, and all through the streets of the city. people are going through garbage and ash cans to see what they can find in the way of heterogeneous lists of articles. The Times does not say what these things were, but probably the list was made up of something delightfully and quaintly absurd, such as old shoes, bits of string, cardboard packing boxes, wire, old furniture, clothing, and food. If the several guests at the Waldorf had to scavenger night after night and morning after morning, the hunt would not have had such an enthusiastic response. Voluntary poverty, feeding the hungry and giving rooms if they needed it, and another tenet was communal living. Over the next years, houses of hospitality, known as Catholic worker houses, sprung up all over the United States. I think at one time there were at least 40 of these houses. When W.H. Auden was interviewed by the paper and said, what is this? What do these Catholic worker people do? His reply was, they help the undeserving poor. Young people and college students were attracted to the movement, and they lived in the houses, which served as temporary shelters for the homeless. People came and people left, but they all lived together in community for a certain amount of time, just like Jesus commanded us to live, Dorothy Day said. And the other tenet was absolute pacifism. This seemed very obvious to Peter and Dorothy. Dorothy had participated in many nonviolent marches most of her adult life. She believed in civil disobedience and was arrested and jailed at least 8 times walking with Cesar Chavez, women's rights, the rights of or to be a war tax resister. And in prison she wrote, all through those weary first days in jail, when I was in solitary confinement, the only thoughts that brought comfort to my soul were those lines in the Psalms that express the terror and misery of man suddenly stricken and abandoned. Solitude and hunger and weariness of spirit, these sharpened my perceptions so that I suffered not only my own sorrow, but the sorrow of those about me. I was no longer myself. I was humanity. I was no longer a young girl, part of the radical movement seeking justice for those oppressed. I was the oppressed. I was that drug addict, screaming and tossing in her cell, beating her head against the wall. I was the shoplifter who for rebellion was sentenced to solitary. I was that woman who had killed her children, who had murdered her lover. The blackness of hell was all around me. The sorrows of the world encompassed me. I was like one gone down to the pit. Hope had forsaken me. I was the mother whose child had been raped and slain. I was the mother who had borne the monster who had done it. I was even that monster, feeling in my heart every abomination. Once the IRS came and said to Dorothy Day, you owe us a lot of back taxes. And she said, good, you figure up how much I owe you, and then I won't pay it. And I think this is very true. She said, if you're not totally engaged in a lifestyle, you won't have any fun. Our family just got back from Cabo San Lucas, Mexico. Well, not. We went there, when was it, John? April.
Early May.
Kind of a part of the all-year-long 50th wedding anniversary celebration. Cabo San Lucas is not really Mexico, even though it's halfway down the coast. It's more like a tourist place. Gringo Tenango, they would say, in Guatemala. But I noticed something about myself, and I've noticed this every time I go to the beach. Our young grandchildren are out in the waves just having a wonderful time, screaming and yelling and can hardly wait till the waves come up and knock them down so they can get up and go again. Our older granddaughters are lying back here, pretty far back, slavishly, or whatever the word is, with suntan lotion, you know, and holding aluminum foil up and getting this wonderful tan, happy as larks. I am in between those, doing nothing but getting mad that there's sand in my shoes and that I can't get out. And I mean, I just don't enjoy the beach because I don't do one or the other thing. And I think that's true about our life. If we don't go totally into something and just dabble around at it, it isn't going to be much fun. It isn't going to bring much fulfillment or much joy. But I think Dorothy Day was one example of a person who went absolutely all the way into a particular lifestyle because she believed that Jesus commanded us to live this way. She lived and wrote and argued and demonstrated the preferential option for the poor that theologians later on would talk about. The pacifism was taught to everyone that lived in the Catholic worker house, and I remember a friend of ours telling us a story about a nun who was all alone in one of those Catholic worker houses. 3 a.m, she opened her eyes and there was a man leaning over her bed. And her first instinct was to surprise the man, so she said, "What time is it?" And he looked at his watch and he said, "I have a little after 3. She said, "Oh, really? I have a little before 3. I wonder if my watch is stopped." And she shakes her watch and listens. And she said, "Well, I can't believe it. We don't have the same time." And she got out of bed and was just standing there looking at her. She said, "Well, not exactly. What are you doing in my room here?" And he said, "Oh, well, I was just looking for a place to stay." And she said, "Well, you're not going to stay in my room." You marched down the hall, and she took him down the hall and into a room, you know. I mean, just so much part of her life that nonviolence, and she had been trained in all the aspects of nonviolence, and that surprise is one of those things that you do to disarm a person that you think might be possibly harming you. In the 1970s, or in her 70s, she moved with a cane, and her body was very arthritic. And if you've seen pictures of Dorothy Day, she always looks like this. Her hair is white, yellow hair, not real attractive, always wound around the top of her head. She wore it that way forever and ever. She continued to live and work among the poor and the destitute, even though she wasn't in good health. She was always on the right side of all the crucial battles. For nonviolence, against all wars, for the workers, against boardroom execs, for the hungry and the homeless, against the blindly comfortable. And at the age of 83, after a long illness, Dorothy Day died in November of 1980 in one of the 40 hospitality houses, one called Mary House in New York City. Before she died, she arranged with a Jewish undertaker to have her body put in a pine box because he was the only undertaker in New York City that she could find that had pine coffins. The time of her funeral on December 2nd was scheduled to coincide with the end of the daily soup line. There were dignitaries from the Roman Catholic Church, bishops and archbishops, other denominations. Cesar Chavez was there, Henry Nouwen. But the vast majority of the 1,000 people who attended the funeral were just people who had come to love her, understood what the Catholic worker had meant to them in their lives. And when the soup line was over, all those men marched down to be part of the funeral. She said before she died that she had failed at many things, her marriages, her role as a parent. She was resentful of the responsibilities that others placed on her, especially Peter Warren. But she never pretended to be all-knowing or all-powerful. She wrote, "Sometimes the only thing that keeps a woman going is the necessity of taking care of her young. She cannot sink into lethargy and despair because the young ones are always dragging on her skirts, clamoring for something, food, clothing, shelter, occupation. When this happens to you, you are carried outside of yourself." Dorothy Day lived faithfully because she used her gifts, especially the gift of writing. She made theology understandable for the common person. She made the complex and demanding message to communicate in a style that was not pretentious. For instance, she said, "Martyrdom is a small, hidden, misunderstood thing. It's not gallantly standing up in front of a firing squad. It's losing your job because you believe in something. It's like not taking a loyalty oath or paying a war tax." Now, whether you agree with her or not, you could not possibly misunderstand her message. She said, obedience is a matter of love, and that makes it voluntary, not compelled by fear or force. Her coffin was carried by her six grandchildren behind the cross into the local parish church. And as the bells tolled, Cardinal Cook blessed the body, and the procession entered the church singing Alleluia. The gospel read were the Beatitudes. And she was buried on Staten Island on a green hillside overlooking a bay that she preferred more than any place in the whole world. Before she died, she said, we have to live this life now. Death changes nothing. If we do not learn to enjoy God now, we never will. If we do not learn to praise and thank and rejoice in God now, we never will. She was also very good at quoting other people or bringing out what other people had said. And one of her favorite essays was a William James excerpt. He said, poverty is indeed a strenuous life. Without bands or uniforms or hysteric popular applause or lies of circumlocutions, and when one sees the way in which wealth getting enters as an ideal into the very bone and marrow of our generation, one wonders whether the revival of the belief that poverty as a worthy religious vocation may not be the transformation of military courage and the spiritual reform which our time stands most in need of. He said, as English-speaking people, we have grown literally afraid to be poor. We despise anyone who elects to be poor in order to simplify and save his or her inner life. If one does not join the scramble, we deem that person spiritless and lacking in ambition or just plain dumb. We have forgotten the ancient truth that we can pay our way by what we are and not by what we have. The right to fling away our life at any moment irresponsibly. I put some questions up on the board just because they were my questions. Maybe they're not your questions. But if you have other questions you'd like to discuss, fine. But when they started the Catholic Worker paper, they said one of the reasons was that we wanted to build a society in which it was easier for people to be good. What do you think they meant by that?
Well, today's society for a poor person is very difficult. I'll give you an illustration of our son, who is disabled by schizophrenia, who works part-time. He is forced by law to not accumulate more than $2,000 in acceptable assets. Now think about that for a moment. How much would you have to accumulate to buy a car? How much would it take to buy a refrigerator and still live and have a reserve? Our society today in our country, in this United States of America, is built on a system which penalizes poor people, which says they are guilty, and assumes that they are trying to take the rest of the taxpayers for some sort of ill-conceived activity. And therefore, for example, my son cannot accept a gift of more than $25 in the state without reporting it. Okay? Now bear in mind, all of these numbers have not been increased for inflation since they were created years and decades ago. Has there been any concern about that? No. Some reasonably good things have happened in recent years in the federal government, like the Ticket to Work program, which enables people to keep their medical benefits even though they earn more than the stated amounts. Because you all know how much you spend for medical insurance for a year. Can poor people afford that?
But how does that make people bad or good? What does she mean by that?
What she's talking about there is that you have to build a society where the rules, I believe, allow a person to be good. In other words, you eliminate some of these senseless and ridiculous and punitive rules and exchange them by rules that allows a person to grow. One of the most valuable things in my son's life is his ability to work. And by the way, because I'm involved in mental health advocacy across the state, that's true of everybody that's mentally ill. They all want to work. And if they work, they want to work more. But all the rules confine them, so they can't work. If you work, do you need a car? Often you do. If you don't need a car, then you need a public transportation system. How good a public transportation system do we have in this state or any other? Some are better than others, but most places. If you don't live in a city, for example, you're particularly handicapped. So we have to build a society where the rules of our society are significantly change in attitude as well as absolute construct if we are going to take care of poor people as part of our society and have that being done within a governmental organization. But if you advocate like I do with a governmental organization, you soon find out that all these ideas are great, but who's going to vote the money? Will people pay the taxes? And the answer in our legislative system across the state today, I would say that 80% or 90% of the legislators will tell you, no, we can't vote anymore doing taxes for anything. Right. So that's the
okay. Answer. Thank you for that. Any other comments on what that might mean?
They say it's he's talking about me. Because I live just on my Social Security. I get help with my rent, and I can have just so much money, and when I do anything, I gotta write down every little thing that I do, and they say this is a free country. I am free. I don't report. If you find out that Ione Erickson is in jail, you know she's
doing
her job and then report what she made. Because I've done that to help pay fixing my car and doing things like that. And like when I come to Holden, I save money, but I almost have to put it under my mattress. Because if I have that much money in my checking account or my savings account, then my rent goes up. So I mean, they say it's a free country, but and it's degrading for a person to go in and get help. Very degrading, especially when you're not used to having to do things like that.
Yes.
I was just going to say that across our country, because of HUD, it may not be a decrease in what the amount is that they've given in the past, but because of inflation and so on, in our community, 27 homes that are already lived in by housing authority homes, those folks are going to have to move out because there isn't enough money this year to subsidize them. So that the federal government has also said that it has a 10-year program to end homelessness. And at least in Clallam County, there are going to be 27 either singles or families without a place to live. And plus, all hope is gone for the waiting list of 200. No, there is not going to be a waiting list anymore. I don't know how you want, yeah, I'm trying to answer the question about for people to be good. I think we have, you know, that's
well,
just
how many
example.
People have to cheat and steal and do
all
kinds of devious things in order to just live? That is not.
That's right. It's not right.
Well, what about, does living faithfully involve voluntary poverty? I mean, some of you sound like you're living there already. What? How off the grid is she? I mean, did Jesus tell us that we had to live like that? What
no,
does that?
We're to be free, and sometimes it gets very overbearing, you know, because I'm at the stage in my life where I want to do so much. Well, it always costs money. And so therefore, I can't do what I really would love to do, because I'm not about to go out and ask for money. You know, they say, well, ask your church. Well, you know, I just don't feel right in asking my church. And it's not easy.
Is voluntary poverty something that we should look at?
Oh, I don't want to look at voluntary poverty.
Well, I think one of the things, one of their tenets that I probably would not be able to do, but this idea of communal living, the idea was making real to each person that participates that it's the good of the whole. Our whole culture and our churches, all of our societies really have just fallen into this thing about rugged individualism. And she talked about the accumulation of goods or whatever it was. You know, they say you're crazy if you don't do that. But that's where we are right now. The idea of the good of the whole, that's what we're talking about for people to be good. And we need to have a concern for the good of the whole. And we are, the tax resistance is, again, that falls in line with this business about it's mine. You know, if you take it away as tax, you take away what's mine.
How many people read that?
What?
Pay it forward.
That's exactly
what they're talking about here. The idea was that you would feel free to give your car away because if you needed a car, somebody else would give it to you. And that's what she's talking about. There's, you know, a society where you would be free to do that. Mm-hmm. Where if somebody needed $20 to buy dinner, you just gave it to them because somebody else would give it to you if you needed it. Mm-hmm. And it was building a society where it was, to be good was easy because everybody was being good.
Was the movie accurate?
The movie was more about the couple. Okay. No, the book was actually, but that's the idea was, it starts off with this guy, this reporter, who crashes his car and somebody walks up with the keys to a BMW and says, here.
Yeah.
And then it goes from there. But that's the idea, was that started from a little kid who just said, I'm gonna do 6 good things, and if I do something good to you, you do 6 more. And it just spread until the point where it was just, that was part of society to just.
So it's Peter Morin's vision, this utopian communistic community. Well, what about the socialism aspect? I mean, I'm sorry.
Can I say something? I've lived in 2 different big cities that I contrast as far as goodness. One is easier to be good in. And the one that I came from was a higher tax city, and we put more money into parks, libraries, things for the common good. The one I live in currently, there is much less taxing, and there is much less public goodness being done as far as parks, public schools, libraries. Where I live, if you want these things, you get it for yourself. And, you know, people have very nice playground systems in their backyards, trampolines, their own swimming pools, that kind of thing. But they continually shut down public swimming pools, for instance. The city I lived in before, they had nice bus shelters for the people that had to use the public transportation. The city I live in now, most people have maids, housekeepers, and they tend to be minorities, and they tend to be older ladies. And there are not even benches at the bus stops, and I think it's obscene that these huge, beautiful, expensive houses, their maids come out and sit on the curbs waiting for the bus. I think that's just an obscenity, because the city I live in does not, you know, tax enough to provide that kind of thing. And the same goes for the mentally ill. I'm a psychiatric nurse, and I there's so many people that we discharge from the hospital with no place to go, just because everything's filled, and we don't have, you know, we haven't put enough money into it.
So is the answer just tax us more? I mean, it's just...
That's one of the answers.
One of them.
The other answer is the Dorothy Day answer. If you want to do it privately, if you want to do it, and there's graduations in between, systems in between that you can think about. But the point of the matter is that in today's America, many of our leaders are not thinking about any of these things.
No, they don't even know
any of them.
Well. She said that we give out bread to change the social order. Do you think she was doing that? I mean, what is that, just charity, or is that in some way changing the social order? Was Dorothy Day working on the wrong end of this problem? Should she have been protesting and writing to her congressman instead of...
Well, she was, and basically she was protesting, you know, by helping them and spreading the news.
But was she really changing the social order?
No.
I think you talk about tension. You have to have both, as far as what I can see. And I don't really know how to go about this. But you have to build a society where there is policy that starts from the bottom and starts from the top. It has to be public policy that people have enough. And I don't want to mention the B word. I don't want to mention the boy emperor. But when you have public policy where it's encouraged that in order to be patriotic, after we had the Twin Towers go down, that we just go out and do more shopping, you're not going to build a society where people care about each other. Mm-hmm. And I think that she was right there when, or whatever the guy's name was that was her friend,
Peter Maron,
when the paper, the goal of the paper was to build a better society. I think that maybe they wanted to change the hearts of people, and they did that in a way. And so how do we now address the issues like you're so concerned about, so that people are not just looking out for me and what kind of a house do I live in, but caring about the people who work for them?
I want to give one answer to that question, because I'm on the board of Lutheran Public Policy for the state of Washington.
Okay.
The budget is a meager $64,000 a year that our director gets, and that includes half salary for an intern, housing for the intern, travel across the state, and it's a long way from Spokane to Seattle. $64,000. Our synod, three synods make up this region for Lutheran Public Policy, give $750. I think one thing we could do is talk to our churches and
yes.
say, Lutheran Public Policy is how laws get changed. The stuff that LPPO has been doing in the state of Washington, I'm very proud to be part of that board, because they understand the legislative system. They're always letting you know when a congressperson has to be written to or called. They give you... To take care of the least among us takes some political clout,
yes.
not just handing out bread, as much as I would, I mean, that's what I would rather do.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I want to mention is in Marcus Borg's new book, The Heart of Christianity, it really struck me last week when we were reading a chapter about how do you give your benevolence? Does it go to change structures, or is it just charity? And so I started going down the places where we give money, and there are very few places where John and I contribute that I think really goes to change systems. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's something we need to look at.
But if you don't do them both at the same time, then none of the preventive stuff gets done at all.
Right.
I mean, locally, if you're not working to... So we have a system that's going to fail 27 families. So what happens? I mean...
You can't wait for the system to change.
We can't.
No. You know, there's that wonderful story about the church group that went on a picnic by the river. And as they were eating their fried chicken, they saw a body floating down and going, help, help, help. And they ran out and they dragged the person in and gave them artificial respiration or CPR. Dried them off, gave them food, and they went about their business. And pretty soon, an hour later, another person comes floating down the river and they run out. Well, this happened all afternoon. And finally, someone got smart and said, we need to go upstream to where the bridge is and see what's happened up there. They go up there, and the bridge is at a curve. And cars and pedestrians and bicyclists were coming around. The bridge was out, they were dropping into the water. Well, the point being that you've also got to go up there and fix the bridge, but you can't let them float by and just say, or something like that. Yeah.
Well, and this is probably where gifts come in, because it is just as important for the people to go repair the bridge. And it's just as important for some people to make sure that the people going downstream, and because we're created uniquely, we have to provide opportunities to trigger that gift inside you. Because if you're trying to serve in a mode that isn't your gift, you're going to get burnout and bored in about a minute and a half, is my experience. But if you can ignite what God gave you to do, it's unstoppable, and then you don't have to live in an either or kind of, we have to do this or we have to do this. You can just trust that the Holy Spirit can work through everyone. And I use that in my job. I work with Habitat. Mm-hmm. And I try to remind people, you don't have to swing the hammer. Hey, building a house. But I sure love talking. But the house couldn't get built without either one, without finding the people to help build the house and the people, you know, to build the house. So I think as a society, that's a way to help a society promote goodness. Mm-hmm. You have more opportunities and not be so narrow. We need to all do this now, or we all need to do this now. I think it comes back to prayer. And what does God, living faithfully, what is he calling you to do? Because he's got this pretty well figured out. If you just join in.
You know, to what you're saying, I absolutely agree, because I work with a bunch of nurses, doctors, and social workers, and we just kill ourselves giving. We work with the mentally ill people, and we put so much energy, and we're always bringing clothes, and we give money, and we just, I mean, we do so much for an individual person. But it's like the boy who stuck his finger in the hole in the dike. I mean, it's mm-hmm. we're just drowning, and really, I mean, it's dawning on us that what we need to do is go down to Austin to the legislature and start, you know, talking to some of the legislators.
Well, and technically, isn't that exactly what happened with Dorothy Day's houses? The Catholic Church picked up the ball. And they started bringing stuff. I mean, she would have run out of extra coats and extra loaves of bread immediately.
But they were individual people, not the church as a whole, as an institution. I mean, the church didn't say, oh good, we're going to take this on as an arm of the church.
But it was churches, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't that what you
yeah,
read?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The church people came
church
to her aid.
Church people
aim, yes.
Heard about this and recognized that this is a place that they could help. And so, yeah.
But it wasn't changing the structures that caused the people to be where they were. Yeah.
I think that giving the bread can change the social order, because you have people who are not always working at giving the bread who come in, and their hearts can be changed. And then if you are informed about what social policy needs to be changed, and you say, as you were saying, the network you have within your Lutheran Social Services or whatever you call it now, that you let people know what letters they need to write, and you have maybe even ways for them to lobby and do these sorts of things. I have found through personal experience that people will get involved politically and try to change policy. So I think that's how giving the birth can change the social order. It also assuages people's consciences to give the bread, and that's a downside.
Now, when you're asked the question of does it involve voluntary poverty, I would say not necessarily. I know of people of means who use that means in such a way to help, for instance, scholarships for people who might not be able to afford or something of that sort. And if they were poor themselves, they were living on a poverty level themselves, they wouldn't have the means to help in that way. So there are different ways of helping. And the faithfully part is how we use what we have.
Do you think the money you have is a gift?
I mean,
or why does God give us money and not the next family?
I personally do, and I am conscious of that. And I don't know, that's a question I'm asking.
John Wesley says that you earn more so that you can give away more.
Well, that's a tough one. I mean, I think we should close now because I don't have any answers.